This week on Making Contact.
We need to look at the role of multinational companies doing business in Africa and what has been the ethics in doing this kind of business in Africa. Because why is this continent the potentially the richest continent on the face of the earth? It's the continent which has the poorest of peoples.
When President Bush made a one-week tour of the African continent in early July 2003, the U.S. public heard a lot about human suffering and conflict there. The tragic AIDS epidemic and the toll of bloody wars are critical issues that should be examined in depth. Yet one key component seemed to be missing from the coverage: multinational corporate interests and their effects on people in African nations. On this edition of Making Contact, we take a look at some examples. In Tanzania, a Canadian-based corporation is accused of burying alive artisan miners in order to acquire control of a gold mine. And the drive for oil has sparked political and social upheavals in Sudan and Angola. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. As war and political instability in the Middle East have led to calls for more diversified sources of U.S. oil imports away from the flashpoints of the Persian Gulf region, the United States has been cultivating ties with the oil-producing nations of Africa. Whether in Angola, Equatorial Guinea, Chad, or Sao Tome, U.S. energy conglomerates are expanding their business interests. Yet the history of oil exploitation in Africa has almost invariably been one of economic mismanagement, corruption, civil strife, and environmental degradation. Correspondent Rupert Cook reports.
It's Sunday morning in the small village of Magang, which is in the eastern Upper Nile. This is a Dinka community. I'm in the local church, which is really just an enclosure fenced off with a round grass wall. This area is an SPLA-held rebel area of the eastern Upper Nile. Some of the men here are wearing military fatigues. Most men are soldiers. It's a heavily militarized zone of the conflict.
Southern Sudan is one of the least developed places in the world. In Sobak County, not far from the front lines of the 20-year war between the predominantly Christian Southern Sudanese rebels and the radical Islamist government in the capital Khartoum, there are no schools, no roads, and only one tiny health clinic for hundreds of thousands of people. Yet, just a few days' journey from Magang along the Nile, foreign oil companies are hard at work drilling and installing pipelines to transport extracted oil to a refinery in the north of the country. According to the international non-governmental organization Christian Aid, the Sudanese government makes $1 million a day from the oil fields of the Upper Nile. Most of the revenue is spent on arms. Perhaps not surprisingly, oil has become a major factor in Sudan's civil war. Niang Chol is a senior official with RAS, the humanitarian wing of the rebel SPDF faction.
In fact, people are fighting over the exploitation of oil, and the oil field has become the center of conflict. Rebel forces are fighting in order to close down the oil fields, and the government is fighting, doing its utmost best to extract the oil in order to sponsor their war effort. But that is the real situation. People are displaced, are removed by force by the government in order to extract oil. And from time it is a conflict zone. Most of the people either they go very far, especially in Western Upper Nile. So people are suffering.
The extraction of oil in the Upper Nile region of southern Sudan is also a major factor when it comes to the massive human rights abuses suffered by the civilian population. Leslie Levko is a human rights specialist with humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders.
Certainly, the development of the oil is a factor in that area. In 1997, the area started going up in flames and has basically been in flames ever since. That happens to coincide with the oil development, so it clearly seems to be a factor. the strategies used have become more brutal. People are now deliberately being targeted and killed, which is therefore that much more devastating for civilians. We clearly do see that there was a marked change in the environment when oil development began.
In Africa, the discovery and exploitation of oil has had a distinctly checkered history. Oil does provide wealth, but it can also provoke conflict. Whether in Sudan, Congo-Brazzaville, Nigeria, or Angola, commercial oil exploitation often accompanies civil strife or war. Central to the problem is the issue of the oil wealth's distribution. Too often, hundreds of millions of dollars have passed from the coffers of the global oil multinationals only to disappear into the offshore accounts of the ruling elite, leaving nothing for the population. Such inequities can provide the spark for decades of bloody conflict. But while homegrown corruption is undoubtedly a key factor, there also remains the responsibility of the foreign multinationals. Sam Ibok is Director of Political Affairs with the African Union, or AU.
I think quite clearly the issue of resources is becoming a very serious and challenging one to deal with for us in Africa. Because if you look around the continent, you will discover that most of the countries which have the potentials to be the richest and most endowed countries on this continent are experiencing one sort of instability or the other. Let me also be frank, it's not just a problem which has been created by Africans. It is a problem which has also its roots outside the continent in the exploitation of these resources, in the how these resources are used. I think that both Africans and non-Africans have had a share. And I think we need to look at the role, for instance, also of multinational companies doing business in Africa and what has been the ethics in doing this kind of business in Africa. Because why is this continent the potentially the richest continent on the face of the earth? Is the continent which has the poorest of peoples? It is because we have not been able to use the resources that we have on the continent in a way that will benefit all of our people.
Fugir a guerra devido ao sofrimento, Nita matava, massacrava, por isso que nós fugimos da província.
He says he came here because of the suffering, because of UNITA soldiers killed the people in the province. He needs schools, he needs hospitals and some food to eat also, because the lack of food in this camp. He is hungry and also water. There is no water, there is no clothes to wear, and a lot of things is missing here in the camp.
Philippe Gaspar is 13 years old. He lives as a refugee in Vila Nova, a barren camp for internally displaced people just outside Angola's capital, Luanda. Until the death in 2002 of rebel leader Jonas Savimbi, Angola's civil war had dragged on for more than 25 years at the cost of 1.5 million lives. Rooted in the proxy conflicts of the Cold War, the conflict had in the 1990s become a brutal battle for the country's natural resources, diamonds and especially oil. As in Sudan, Angola's citizens are very poor, despite the fact that its oil production will soon outstrip that of Kuwait. Angola currently supplies about 8% of US oil imports, with plans to increase its share to 15%. Due to corruption, very little of the estimated annual $3 to $5 billion of oil revenue filters down to the millions of hungry Angolans like Philippe Gaspar. According to the international human rights NGO Global Witness, up to $1.4 billion in oil-related revenues and bank loans were unaccounted for in the year 2001 alone. Meanwhile, three-quarters of Angolans have to subsist on less than a dollar a day. The situation seems unlikely to improve. When oil multinational BP announced in 2002 that it would in the future make its Angola accounts public in the interests of transparency, the Angolan government reacted with fury, threatening to exclude BP from all future contracts. Chantal Uimana is Africa Programme Officer for Transparency International, an organisation that's devoted to combating corruption.
I think that was rather an unfortunate decision from the Angolan government, because most of the time it's rather difficult to get the companies to take such a positive move. It's a really a sign of, if not a lack, but at least a weak political will. And I think the Angolan civil society has also a challenge there to really work towards influencing the authorities and to move it towards more transparency and accountability.
Pressure from civil society groups in Africa and beyond has been a major impetus to force oil conglomerates to pay more heed to the risks of oil-related corruption and conflict. Under heavy pressure in its native Canada, multinational Talisman recently announced that it was pulling out of southern Sudan. And some commentators are now pointing to Chad as a new benchmark for the oil industry in Africa. Landlocked and threatened by encroaching desertification, Chad is another of the poorest countries in the world. However, there are hopes that the new Chad-Cameroon oil pipeline, from the Chadian oil fields in the south to the Cameroonian coast, will bring in much-needed revenue to the country. The oil pipeline and extraction project is one of the largest ever in Africa. Mainly operated by US oil multinational ExxonMobil, the total cost will be around $4 billion, with expected revenues over 25 years of about $6 billion. What makes it different, though, is that the new Chad-Cameroon pipeline is supported by the World Bank. And in return for its involvement, the bank has imposed strict conditions regarding the project's environmental impact and the transparent handling of oil revenues. Gregor Binkert is resident country representative for the World Bank in Chad.
We have two challenges. One is on the environmental side, to make this a project where there is no significant environmental problems. Secondly, it's the management of oil revenues, which has been a problem in most African countries. The oil revenues will be paid by the consortium into an offshore bank account. So it will not go to the treasury first. It goes into an offshore bank account. From that offshore bank account, it can only be transferred to the treasury with the explicit authorization of a college that is set up of 9 people, 4 of which from civil society, then from the Supreme Court, 2 members of parliament sit there. There is the director of the treasury is in there, and the national director of the central bank. 10% of the oil revenues goes to a future generation fund. And of the remaining 90%, 80% will go to the 4 priority sectors, education, health, infrastructure, which mainly means roads, of course, and rural development.
Although the Chadian government will receive an estimated $2 billion over 25 years from the project, some contend that the human and environmental costs far outweigh the financial benefits. Onga Yoronga is the leading political figure in opposition to Chadian head of state, President Deby. He's also a deputy in the National Assembly, representing the area most affected by the pipeline project, as well as being its most outspoken critic.
Ce projet ne vaut pas la peine. Admettons que ce projet se passe en Europe ou en Amérique. Est-ce que ce serait pareil?
Assuming that this project was in Europe or North America, would it be done the same way? I don't think so, because they will be in of black African doesn't have any value, and that why we have been thrown to the lions in this way. Under the pretext that it is a project which is reducing poverty, $50 million a year, do you think that is going to do much to develop Chad? No, I don't think so. And our loss is going to be much more than $50 million a year. The costs are enormous in terms of both human and environmental costs. And I am not afraid to say it. This is a project which has disaster human implication and it's political macabre.
While criticism of the project's social and environmental costs has intensified in recent months, outside Chad, hopes are high that it will at least be an improvement on the disastrous practices of the past. With the pipeline still not fully operational until later this year, the jury remains out on Chad's experiment in reasonably responsible oil exploitation. Seen from the refugee camps of Angola and Sudan, talk of conditionality, transparency, corporate responsibility, and benchmarks must seem rather belated. For Making Contact, I'm Rupert Cook in Sobek County, Southern Sudan.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, or you would like to contact any of our guests, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. It's a common story in Africa. A large multinational corporation pressures a cash-strapped country, often with assistance from international financial institutions such as the World Bank, to allow it access to natural resources. The financially dependent country reluctantly agrees, despite ominous social, environmental, economic, and legal implications. Tanzania, located in East Africa, is one such country. Currently, Tanzania is the fourth poorest nation in the world. In 1996, Sutton Resources, a Canadian gold mining company, was hoping to be bought out by Barrick Gold Corporation, also of Canada. Sutton had been exploring a mine known as Bulyanhulu in Tanzania, which the company predicted would be one of the best gold-producing regions in the world. There was a problem, however. Living on the property were as many as 400,000 small-scale indigenous miners and their families. Eager to sell the company and pass along negotiations for the Bulyanhulu mine, Sutton, with the help of the Canadian government, allegedly worked to forcibly remove the local miners. Making Contact's Rosalind Fay has more.
Bulyanhulu, located about 50 miles south of Lake Victoria in Tanzania, had been home for decades to hundreds of thousands of indigenous small-scale gold miners and their families. That was until Sutton Resources, a Canadian gold mining company, set its sights on the gold-rich land. In 1993, the government of Tanzania granted an association representing the indigenous miners title to the Bulyanhulu mine. Tanzanian human rights attorney Tundu Lissu says that although Sutton and KMCL were granted a license in 1994 to mine in areas near Bulyanhulu, they have never been granted a license to mine at Bulyanhulu. According to Lissu, not only did KMCL not have a license to operate in Bulyanhulu, they continue operating in violation of a court order issued by the Tanzanian High Court. That order, given in June 1995, denied KMCL's request to evict the miners from the property and referred the case to a constitutional judicial panel. KMCL appealed the ruling in October of that year, but withdrew its appeal 7 months later in May of 1996. Despite the court ruling, 2 months later, the Tanzanian government issued eviction orders for the miners, giving them 1 month to leave. The evictions, however, began less than 24 hours later. At the time, Hamisi Mayunga Marisho was an artisanal miner and a resident of Kakola Village in the Bulyanhulu area. According to his testimony, during the week of July 30, 1996, Sutton's subsidiary KMCL moved onto the Bulyanhulu mining site accompanied by Tanzanian military police. It's a chilling story, retold here, of being buried alive along with four other miners after KMCL ordered bulldozers to fill in and level the mine shafts.
On August 7, 1996, I was supervising work in a pit number 86C at reef number 1, which I owned with one Nambi Musabi. I descended into the pit with four other colleagues and we start breaking the rock containing gold ore. I start noticing a cloud of dust and lots of sand descending into the pit. Things got difficult. But with God's help, we start digging our way out from one opening in our pit. This went on very slowly, and by August 8, 1996, two of my colleagues were unable to continue digging, and they died right there. This leaves me together with Turo Masanja and Abdu Musa at around 10 o'clock on the night of August 9, 1996. I managed to get an opening with had
a wood pole tied on the side of the pole, and I clambered on the poles and started ascending. At the same time, my other colleagues were following behind. Sand and dust continued to come in from high above. Unfortunately, my two colleagues died after Turo Masanja slipped and tumbled down, taking Abdul Musa with him. I continued to climb up until I managed to get out, only to find that a bulldozer had leveled the entire area. With much difficulty and with help from other miners, I managed to reach Kakula village.
In 1999, as a research fellow for the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., attorney Tundu Lissu began investigating and gathering evidence of the evictions at Bulyanhulu. He says the evidence he's collected, including photographs of corpses, eyewitness testimony, and a police video showing bodies being exhumed from pits, confirmed the miners were driven off the property by force. He also claims that some who resisted were shot, and as many as 52 miners were buried alive.
I was able to collect evidence in the form of video tapes from the company, from the police, with numerous photographs of the dead. People were shot dead by the police, as well as talking to eyewitnesses, to the friends and family of those who died and who were missing.
Lissu claims that based on the evidence he and others have collected, the evictions ordered by the Tanzanian government took place illegally and in direct violation of the High Court injunction.
After this, the destruction settlement started, the miners rushed to court asked the court to intervene on their behalf. And so on the 2nd of August, the High Court once again issued injunction against the company and against the government to prevent them from continuing with the evictions. That injunction was also ignored, and the evictions went ahead. The evictions were carried out illegally and in flagrant violation of the order of the court.
So why did the Tanzanian government, known as one of the least corrupt in all of Africa, violate their own rule of law?
We were able, for instance, to get evidence in the form of documents from the Canadian Foreign Ministry, and we got this from our friends and supporters in Canada. And these documents prove that there was massive pressure from the Canadian government to the government of Tanzania to get the artisanal miners out of the way.
According to Lissu, it wasn't only political pressure from the Canadian High Commissioner that drove the Tanzanian government to ultimately evict the miners, but also behind-the-scenes pressure from members of Barrick's International Advisory Board, which includes the former Prime Minister of Canada, Brian Mulroney, and former President George Bush Sr. Greg Pallast, investigative reporter for the BBC and author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, began investigating Barrick Gold and its connections to the Bush family in 1999.
Barrick Gold Corporation is a very interesting corporation. There's no Joe Barrick in the phone book. It was founded a couple of decades ago by that well-known Canadian Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian arms dealer who was at the center of the Iran-Contra scandal. He left when the scandal broke and later joining the corporation as its international advisor was George Herbert Walker Bush, who hopped onto the Barrick board or as a Barrick board advisor after he left the White House.
In 1999, Pallast ran across Amnesty International's annual report, which had for the third year in a row called for an independent investigation of the events at Bulyanhulu. He wrote an article about Amnesty's report for the London Observer in 2000 and was soon sued for libel by Barrick.
My paper, because of the horrendous British libel laws, agreed to give them some money on the idea that someone could read into the story words that weren't there. But the judge ruled absolutely from the bench because human rights groups handed him evidence of the killings. Very unusual, an extraordinary outcome in a British court that human rights groups, which had nothing, no participation in the case, simply went straight to the judge and based on what they gave him, he ruled that Barrick could never say that my paper had found that no one died at Bulyanhulu. So it was extraordinary victory for human rights groups. But that didn't save Tundu Lissu, who still is facing these charges. And it doesn't save, of course, the miners' lives who are gone.
Once we started talking about these issues and the evidence in public, the government unleashed its terror machine. So our offices and homes have been raided. We have been arrested. I was arrested on coming back from the U.S. last December. And since May last year, we have been subject of criminal charges for sedition in the courts here. That is aside from the massive campaign of intimidation that has been unleashed against the former artisanal miners and eyewitnesses who have spoken to us. They have been massively harassed, and they're intimidated.
In addition to being the subject of ongoing harassment by the Tanzanian authorities and being charged with sedition, Lissu and the World Resources Institute have also been threatened with libel lawsuits from Barrick. Numerous media organizations, including the London Observer, have also been subjected to lawsuits or threats of lawsuits from Barrick for reporting the allegations.
Free and independent press in America is a laugh, let's face it. I could report this story in Britain despite the fact that my paper had to pay thousands to defend our position. Yet in America, we could do it for free, and you couldn't get it in the American press for love nor money. No one cared. It's just a bunch of dead Africans. No one cares. And especially with the cost of the threats of facing down Barrick, couldn't get it in anywhere. That's why I put it in the book, because it's the only way I could blast it into the American consciousness.
Greg Palast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. To get a copy of his book, you can visit Greg Palast's website at www.gregpalast.com. That's gregpalast.com. So far, calls for an independent investigation continue to fall on deaf ears within the Tanzanian government and at Barrick. Barrick says that a 1998 World Bank inquiry into the events that found no wrongdoing is sufficient. Others, including Tundu Lissu, Amnesty International, and numerous other international human rights groups say, given the World Bank's huge financial stake in the project, the inquiry cannot be considered impartial. In the meantime, Lissu continues to call for justice for the thousands of displaced Tanzanian miners and their families, and for a full and independent investigation into the alleged killings at Bulyanhulu. We spoke with Barrick's spokesman, Vincent Borg, but he declined to be interviewed. Meanwhile, Lissu says international pressure on governments such as the U.S. can make a big impact on whether an independent investigation is to occur.
The U.S. government has a powerful say in the World Bank, and the World Bank is using taxpayers' money to support an investment that is clearly inconsistent with the interests of the Tanzanian people. And therefore, my call to the American people is to put pressure to bear on their government to ensure justice is done in this case.
For Making Contact, I'm Rosalind Fay.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at Africa in corporate interests. Thanks for listening. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Lisa Rubman is our executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerleau, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national advisor David Barsamian, and our managing producer Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.